I'm Rachel Schofield. Thanks for joining us here at Bookomi, where we're all about a bit of gentle mind expansion. The books we bring you are full of original, memorable insights. That's the OMI. And they come from some of the most wanted minds in business, science, tech, and culture. In this episode...
My name is Leroy Logan, author of Closing Ranks, and this is my OMI for Bookomi.
We are cranking up the sirens and hitting the blue lights in the company of retired Superintendent Leroy Logan, MBE, founder member of the Black Police Association. His 30-year career as a black officer in the Metropolitan Police makes him perfectly placed to reflect on what has and hasn't changed in race relations in modern-day Britain.
I was causing good trouble because I would speak up for people, speak up for the community, And as I went through the ranks, I found people were attracted to me to advocate on their behalf.
In Closing Ranks, My Life as a Cop, we hear what made a gifted scientist become a police recruit, despite the huge reservations of his Jamaican father and the mistrust of the police within his North London community. The quickest way to cut your Christmas card list by 99% is to become a police officer, suggests Leroy. But if he'd hoped to find new friends within the force, that wasn't going to be easy either. His book charts the highs and lows of his career, complete with the hostility and prejudice he often encountered. Oh, and his life is about to hit the small screen in a new BBC and Amazon series called Small Acts, telling stories from London's Caribbean community between the 1960s and 80s. Its Oscar-winning British director is Steve McQueen, and he's cast Star Wars actor John Boyega as Leroy. Leroy, welcome to Bookomi.
Wow, that's a lovely intro.
Oh, good. Well, listen, that I was thinking that must be a really powerful thing, maybe even a kind of vindication of your whole career to have your life experiences recognised as important to share by an internationally acclaimed film director.
Yeah, I mean, it's beyond my wildest dreams. I couldn't have penned this out myself. There's some divine intervention in there somewhere, and I'm just very humbled by it.
Yeah, and I mean, people have different definitions of success. You're now sitting in a position where you're looking back over 30 years of service in the Metropolitan Police. You've written the book. There's now this TV episode. Would that have been your definition of success, sort of reaching those kind of heights?
Do you know, my definition of success is successes. So for me, the journey continues because my successes are obviously my children and grandchildren, but also the young people that I've worked with over 20 years with my charity Voyage Youth, which came out of the Black Police Association, and how they are progressing, as well as the wider number of young people across London and our cities, you know, just wanted to see them get, you know, an opportunity to achieve their true potential. So for me, that's real success, seeing tangible changes in people's lives. And if in the process I get some acknowledgement for that, well, so be it. I don't take myself that seriously, that, you know, it's all about accolades and how many likes I get on Twitter and stuff like that. It's really about impact and outcomes.
Yeah, actually, we'll talk about this later, but I think you're someone who said you were quite used to being unpopular. We'll talk about that later. But just on this issue of the book and the TV episode, I was thinking that's going to be, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but that's going to be to some extent an interpretation of how somebody else sees you and your story. And I wonder how you see yourself. You say in the book, I'm a black man who happens to be a cop.
Yeah, well, I'm still a black man in retirement, and it's very surreal, the whole process, from when Steve McQueen said, listen, Leroy, we really like your story and we want to put it forward to the BBC. And it came about that I was involved in the script, went on set, saw John playing me out. I even saw him getting measured up by my school friend, Charlie Allen, who's a tailor. And he used to make my clothes in the 70s and 80s. And I see John Boyega dressed up in the same way as me. You know, it's, but no, I haven't actually seen it yet. So I'm really on sort of tenterhooks, thinking, what is it going to be like? But knowing Steve, he's an amazing guy. I know it's going to be great. So I'm comfortable with it. And I know it's good. Having spoken to John a few times and seeing him in action on set, I'm really anticipating a very good production, as well as the other episodes of the Small Axe series. It's looking really, really awesome. And it's so timely with the whole Black Lives Matter and the whole momentum of change that people want, regardless of their background or culture.
Yeah. And as you say, it's a series of insights into London's Caribbean community. It takes us back to the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. Let's go there with you, because that's where your book takes us as well. It tells us a lot about your life growing up as a young Black kid in North London. What are the strong memories for you from that time?
I think the strong memories were actually underpinned by my short few years in Jamaica, because I was born in Islington, in the Royal Free Hospital, the old one, which was in Liverpool Road, which is quite ironical. I end up as a scientist years later in the new hospital in Hampstead. But when I was at primary school stage, I had a few years in Jamaica, and I had this really cultural immersion of seeing Black teachers and doctors and even Black cops. And it gave me such a sense of empowerment. And, you know, I had a bit of a superiority complex. I suppose that'll account for my arrogance and overbearing nature. But it gave me a sense of identity and real conviction of who I was. And I suppose that was underpinned by my parents. So growing up in Islington, especially in primary school, and finish off primary school and, of course, secondary school, I got a real buzz trying to tell people, listen, we can do these things. You know, we don't have to feel inferior, you know. And I suppose that, again, was given a lot more credence when I was at Highbury Grove Secondary School for Boys. And we used to go to this cultural bookshop in Highbury Corner, where the actual current Highbury Corner Court is. And that, again, was such a form of rich historical breakthroughs for me. And so my discovery in that time was so wide, not only about the area I lived in, people I related to, but also my knowledge, my thirst for knowledge, and based on the empowerment process I had in Jamaica. So it was a positive one. I must admit, I'm trapped in the 70s, and the music was positive. And I must admit, I just felt, and the world's our oyster, basically.
That's so interesting to me. And I think that difference that you highlight in the book, that it made to you to have spent some years back in Jamaica. Your parents had come over to the UK in the 50s, but as you say, you went back just temporarily with your mum for a while. And that perhaps gave you a different sense of self to children of colour who'd been born in the UK, had this heritage, but had never had the chance to connect with it.
Yeah, I must admit, I did try and put across my infectious optimism about these things are possible. Because, you know, there were certain times when career advisors and even some teachers would say, well, actually, maybe pitching your aspirations a bit too high. When I said I want to be a doctor, why would you want to do that? Well, I've seen it in Jamaica. And I suppose that's where my love for science came from. And following that through my education, A-levels, and obviously getting a degree. So I didn't feel that I was going to let anyone define my boundaries. They weren't going to stunt my growth. And I suppose the empowerment I got from my parents and other close friends and relatives, I just felt nothing was going to stop me if I put my mind to it. And so it happened.
Yeah, your parents come through as a powerful force, understandably, in your childhood. And people who tried to help you learn how to negotiate the world you were living in, and particularly the elements of hostility that you might find there because of your background.
Yeah, my father was really a masterclass on survival, really. He made it very clear to me that, Leroy, these are some set rules you need to understand in the culture you're living in. And to be honest, Islington wasn't really extremely bad in that respect, but you still had the common theme of being over-policed and under-protected. You felt through the sus law that anything could happen. I even had relatives rushing back to Jamaica because they used to frequent certain record shops and other areas where they'll congregate, and police would always be driving by and pick a few of them off, and you wouldn't see them for days because in those days you didn't have the accountability and transparency about people being arrested and kept in custody. You know, and I remember saying to one of my cousins that, why should they go back to Jamaica? He said, listen, I went before the magistrate and they said, if I'm in front of them again, they will be put in prison. And he said, I haven't done anything wrong other than hang around a certain record shop. You know, all right, some people were smoking weed and stuff like that, but I wasn't. And I found there were so many people who got criminalized through the sus law in that way. So my father put it clear, front and center, this is what you got to do. Certain routes, go to school, where you play football, where you do your trumpet classes. And invariably, he would picking me up. You know, he was like my taxi service, so it reduced the risk that I could make the wrong sort of choices, be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and, you know, make sure I navigate through the traps.
Yeah. You mentioned the sus laws. Just remind people who aren't familiar with that. This is the suspected person law that was around then that gave the police some quite startling powers.
Yeah. Well, it was very, very draconian at the time because it was based on the Vagrancy Act of 1824, where it was actually a way of enforcing people to go on ships and keeping the streets clear of, you know, vagrants, etc. So it was adopted to the post-war hostility of the Windrush generation. Because remember, that generation, a lot of them fought in the war and they were in the UK during the war and they were heroes. A few years later, they come back on the invitation of the government, and all of a sudden they're zeros, from hero to zero in a short space of time, and the hostile environment in which they had to survive. So it was really because of their survival, my generation was able to survive a bit better and know how to withstand the system, especially of the sus law and how it played itself out. Because if you then got yourself convicted, your life choices were drastically reduced. And my parents were hands on, fingers in to make sure that I didn't fall foul of the system.
Yeah, I remember in the book you talk about your mum vetting your friends and giving you some quite sound advice.
Well, sometimes more than just advice. It was the
direction, shall we say, firm instruction.
Very, very clear instruction. It's either my way or the highway type stuff. But, you know, yeah, I think the blessings of parents and a loving and nurturing household cannot be underestimated, because I know that helped me to survive. Because I remember one time my mother said, right, there's certain chores you've got to do before you even go out to play after school. So I, you know, was doing my chores, and my friends wanted me to go out. I said, no, I've got to deal with something. And unfortunately, they got involved in a real terrible case of gang rape. And unfortunately, a couple of them were convicted of it. And I just think, I wouldn't be involved in that sort of thing anyway, by choice, but just being in the proximity, I could have been arrested, could have been charged, put before the courts, and that would have been devastating at such a young age. And it would have been terrible for my parents, because my parents always told me, do not let the police come to our house. That is a no-no. Do not give the police any opportunity to come to our house. So that was drummed in my head. And I had more fear of my parents than the police, because I knew I just didn't want to disappoint them. I wanted to make sure they were proud of me.
And you made them proud. You went on to do science and excel in that. And you ended up with a job as a research scientist, as you said, at the Royal Free in London. You were busy doing that for, what, 3 years or so? What happened that suddenly led you towards this institution, which, as you've just said, was one that was really not welcome in your house, the police force?
Well, it was several things. I remember Hampstead Police Station was just up the road from the Royal Free, and officers would use our leisure facilities, the gym, the pool, and I'd meet them in the bar afterwards. So I got chatting with them, not knowing they were officers, and eventually they revealed themselves that they were cops. So I started to see the human side, and then I had a bit of a quantum leap. A few years earlier, when I was doing my degree, I was running from one end of a campus to the other of UEL in Newham. And I remember literally stopped in my tracks as I was running, and I saw this black officer in his gleaming white shirt in a marked police vehicle. And I thought, wow, what a brave guy. What a brave guy. So that image was seared in my brain again. And then the images of black cops in Jamaica again came flooding forward. So, and the officers then said, well, you know, why don't you come for a drive round and so forth? So I said, yeah, why not? And that, you know, they're really nice. And I saw what policing was all about from, at least from Leafy Hampstead. And I then was having my appraisal with my boss, Professor Roy Pounder. And he said, Leroy, no problem about your work. We get on well. I can see that we can do some great stuff, but I just cannot see you as a research scientist for the next 30 odd years. So I said, what do you think I should do? He said, you're an outgoing person. You're a people person. I think being a police officer would be good. And I thought, has he been watching me going around on these drive rounds with these cops? Because I couldn't believe that. I said, really? Do I look like a racist cop? And I thought that, actually. I didn't say it to him. And I thought, wow, this is weird. So these thoughts were going through my head, actually policing. And then I remember telling Gretel, who was my fiance at the time, I said to her, listen, Roy is telling me I should become a cop. I'm meeting officers who have shown me certain aspects of being a cop as a real laudable profession. And I said, I don't know what to do. She said, well, why didn't you look into it? And so I started to apply. And this was in early 1982. And I put an application. And because I was a graduate and they're doing a recruiting campaign for black graduates, the Met wanted me in literally within weeks of doing the assessment and the interview. And I said, whoa, time out. Because they want me to join later in 82, about November. And I said, no, could we delay it for 6 months? And they delayed it till June 83. So I was set to do this.
Yeah, so the stars were kind of aligning, but set against all of this was a conversation you were going to have, particularly with your dad, which was going to be a very difficult one.
Absolutely. And that was really caused by my time waiting between late 82 and June 83. My father was beaten up badly by police officers over a road traffic matter. He used to drive large vehicles, and he popped into the local chip shop to have his lunch at home, and the officers said that his vehicle was obstructing the highway And he said, okay, fine, you can report me, but I'll be fighting it in court. And he was measuring up one side of his vehicle to the other side of the road, and they just laid into him. And I got the call from my sister saying that Dad's been beaten up. And I rushed from the Royal Free to the Whittington Hospital, where he had ended up after being taken to the police station and charged. And I actually walked past him because he was so beaten black and blue. He literally was, his face was contorted. And I must admit, if I'd ever tasted and smelt hate in my life, that it was then. Thankfully, I haven't ever had that experience since. And I said immediately, there is no way I was going to be a police officer. I remember going back to Gretel, and she was saying, listen, Leroy, that may be one of the reasons why you should join us. Gretel, that is not the answer I want. Same thing with Roy Pounder, he was saying that. And I remember sharing it with the officers at Hampstead. And they said, well, don't think every officer is the same. And as the final person was my best friend, Lee John. His mother's a community activist in the area. And she said, well, we need a reflective organisation. Pursue it. And I'll speak to your dad. Well, that conversation didn't happen. before some officers from the local division were visiting my home. Now, in those days, officers would visit your home to check you. You know, you're living in a risk-reduced area. You're not living next to someone who's known for criminality or violence or whatever. And they used my old address, which was my parents' address, because I'd moved on. I had a flat in Highbury with Gretel. And they had visited saying, oh, your son is joining the Met. So you can imagine my dad was devastated. What? So I get this phone call saying there's police at my house. I said, but Dad, I haven't done anything wrong. He said, yeah, well, they're saying that you're joining the police. I said, yeah, I meant to tell you about this. And the phone went dead. And, oh, gosh, I thought, wow. And I went back to Jessie and Jessie Stevens. And I said, Jessie, Dad's found out. She said, I'll speak to him. So eventually there was that dialogue established. And amazingly, my dad actually got over his real concerns. And main concern was not only being part of the police that assaulted him, even though he sued them for unlawful arrest and excessive force, successfully so, and was compensated for that. But he was more upset about me turning my back on science and possibly going into medicine, which was my sort of career path at the time. I think that really upset him more than being assaulted by cops. But you know, he supported me, and I remember taking me to Hendon the night before starting in June of 83, and he was there for me till his dying day.
So you started to square the circle, and you mentioned Hendon there, which is the police training college, and I love the expression in your book where you say you arrived at Hendon and you say you could smell the testosterone in the air as you passed through the gates. I mean, this is a place which in many ways, I guess, confirmed a lot of your suspicions about people who joined the police.
Yeah, I knew it was going to be like that because, you remember, science is positively great atmosphere, lovely people from all over the world because it was a teaching hospital with international reputation. And then I'm going into quite a crucible of heat from, you know, macho-driven people who don't celebrate diversity. They don't really understand different cultures and backgrounds. Because I could tell how they operated with my peers and myself on the streets. So you didn't have to be a brain surgeon to figure out how militaristic they are as well. So going into that was a massive, massive shock. And I was really questioning my sanity. Why am I doing this?
What was the answer that you came back with? Because there were obviously a lot of moments where you started to think, is this really right for me? What was the overwhelming answer that came back?
What's this space? I knew I was going in to make a change. And it wasn't just about being a police officer, which I was proud to be, but it had to be something more than that, because I was getting so much hostility from so-called acquaintances, people I knew for years, maybe not really close friends, because my really close friends stuck with me, but I had a lot of hostility from, you know, those people on the periphery, and they say you're a traitor and going into the police, you're letting the side down, all these sort of things. And then I'm going into a culture where the officers saw me with suspicion. They're thinking, black graduate, you're not a youngster like them, 18, 19, I was 26, I was married by then, I had a child on the way, and you thought to yourself, and they thought, there's something about this guy, this just does not add up. So I was between a rock and a hard place, you know, externally with my personal friends, and then internally with my colleagues. So I was really questioning why, but I just sensed, I didn't know what it would look like, but I just sensed that I had a purpose to make some changes from within. Because I remember being told for years, you know, you can't steer a ship from the shore. You've got to be on board in the captain's cabin to change the direction of the ship. And I saw the Met like an oil tanker. It will take years, maybe decades to change. And, you know, I just ran with that and hopefully it would work itself out. And it did.
Yeah. And you gave it 30 years of your life, and it's hard. Your book takes us through many of, as I said, the highs and lows of that. It's hard to summarize on something like this, but take us into some of those memories of those years that you spent as you moved around through the police force with that sense of wanting to change things, and yet very conscious of the hostility that you were at times encountering and the suspicion about what you were doing there and whether you had kind of earned your right to progress as you did.
Well, it started from Hendon being made deputy class captain, and the class captain, Tom Pearson, he was a Sandhurst instructor, so he knew how to present himself, buckle his shoes, and I just copied him because we had adjoining rooms as well. And that gave me a sense, well, okay, I can actually make sure that I integrate, don't assimilate, because I'm a bit older, I'm married, I don't have to assimilate into the norms and values of the culture. I can be myself. And Tom was very similar. So I had a masterclass on how to survive that culture. And then when my first station at Islington, I grew up in that area. So I knew the environment, the people. Obviously, I had to learn how that professional culture in that team, unfortunately, I had the most challenging team. It was renowned throughout that area that a relief was the worst relief to survive. If you're a probationary constable in your first 2 years, because they just thought you were they used to call us sprogs, you know, the lowest of the low. And I remember, again, I stood up to them, which wasn't the greatest of things to do, but I just couldn't let them bully me. And, you know, that I suppose that resulted in me speaking up about the casual racism. And I remember even having a massive N-word written on my locker. And I thought, wow, game on. Because I was a great believer, you know, I wasn't, excellence was the best deterrent. So, you know, whether it's in, you know, carrying out my role as an officer, but also in sporting activities. And invariably, if you're a good sports person, football, athletics, whatever it may be, because in those days, the police was very good standard for sporting activities. I could easily show my worth, and I got grudging respect through that. So it gave me a sense of, you know, strength in myself and my abilities, even though sometimes I got knocked back, applying for posts, saying my face didn't fit, even though my work rate was second to none, and my ethics and integrity stood in good stead. And I was identified by senior officers as someone that they could trust, and they would get me to be their staff officer at Carnival. So, and that's normally for the older officers. And here I was with only a couple of years, or a few years experience, and I'm got a very responsible role with Superintendent Hugh Kinloch. And we shared the same name because my middle name is Hugh. So I was touching to my Scottish roots as well. And yeah, so I got a sense of, well, actually, I can survive this. Because I always said, if I can survive the first 2 years, I can do the other 28. And some of the officers I met in Hendon, minority officers from African Caribbean Asian origins, we kept in touch. And so there was various initiatives which brought us back together, and we started to formulate our ideas about having an association to speak for ourselves. At the same time, I was getting promotion and, you know, starting to make a name for myself. I suppose I could say I was causing good trouble because I would speak up for people, speak up for the community. And as I went through the ranks, I found people were attracted to me to advocate on their behalf.
Yeah, and so you were heavily involved in the birth of the Black Police Association, which I guess a lot of people in the force now would perhaps almost take for granted, but it was a slog to get there. I mean, it took you years to really get to a position where that was accepted and the voice of it was listened to and welcomed.
Yeah, because when we started to, our first founder meeting in April 93, which was actually the same month that Stephen Lawrence was murdered, but we didn't know about the scale of the case then as it built through the years. But we seem to be running in parallel. So, because we even supported them with their private prosecution case, because, you know, the suspects hadn't been brought to justice because of the corruption, incompetence and racism of the officers concerned and their close association with the family. So we realised that the determination, the tenacity of Neville and Dorian Lawrence was something that we needed to honour. And we could not honour it more than when myself and two other members of the Black Police Association were asked to give written and oral evidence at the McPherson inquiry into the death of Stephen Lawrence. And I must admit, it was a massive responsibility, because we knew that once we put our head above the parapet on a global scale, because it wasn't just national, we would be on the target of certain people. And already we had pushback from the Federation saying, you don't need a Black Police Association. You can be a part of a branch of the Federation. We said, well, listen, we are Federation members and you've never done anything for us. Why being a part of a branch of you, you're going to make anything different? So we said, no, we are equal partners. And we will work with you on that basis. And after we gave evidence at McPherson, the reaction, especially when the report finally came out in February 99, that the police service was institutional racist, and they put it front and center on us because we gave that evidence, we realized that the die had been cast for change, and we're hoping that the change would gain momentum. So it was, for me, a realization that this is the work that I was meant to do. In, you know, all those years back, I was thinking, what am I there to do? But I realized this is what I was required to do at a time such as this. And, you know, I felt my faith was keeping me as strong as possible and as resilient as possible to withstand the pressures and not to feel a sense of fear and trepidation. I had to be conscious of how I could be undermined in one way or another, but I had to be strong and convicted in the work I had to do.
Mm. Your faith comes through very strongly in the book. You talk about it very openly. You include Bible verses, a little smattering here and there, and talk about sort of the challenges that you faced spiritually. How important, how defining has your faith been through your police career?
it was been critical. I didn't realize how much it was, really, because I don't actually wear my faith on my sleeve. You know, I'm not going to be dropping Bible verses on you, or say, you know, I'm not going to be on Speaker's Corner doing that. But I know how faith in action has some real practical applications, especially on your approach to a major problem, and not just in policing, because I found my pastoral care working with communities had a real advocacy role. So I'll step even further into that person's, if with their permission, into that person's world and say, well, listen, how can not only solve that problem but prevent it from happening again, and assisting you into supporting yourself better, you know. So I felt my faith gave me that extra compassion for people and wanting to be there for them. So there was that, and also it helped around the work I was doing in the Black Police Association and understanding how we actually assist them, the Met and other police services, to be a more reflective organization, and had a clarity of purpose around that. And, you know, because I saw this not just as helping the organization and the Black Peace Association, but I saw it as advancing truth, advancing honesty, and everything that I was underpinned by my faith. So it really was just casting a light in certain darkened areas of the organization, which needed to be, you know, transparent and open.
Yeah, and because there were some pretty dark places that your career took you. You already mentioned the Stephen Lawrence inquiry. I know in your role at the Black Police Association, some years later, you took a lead in the Damilola Taylor investigation. How did those, what have become iconic in a really awful way, how did those inquiries and investigations shape your thinking and your understanding of the police force and how it still needed to change in your view?
Well, I suppose after the McPherson inquiry recommendations and the police services institutional racist, I knew that the community were looking to us to be the honest broker, you know, and we realized we had to be a critical friend to the organization, because there's nothing wrong with the police service that can't be put right by what's good in it. So it's clear to me and my colleagues that we had to assist. And, you know, it's no use pointing one finger at people when you've got three fingers pointing back at you saying, what are you going to do? So we work with the organization to be more reflective and assist with recruiting and retention and progression. And we wanted to show our ability to assist major investigations. So we used to be involved in critical incidents training of senior investigators. And of course, the tragedy of Damilola gave me an opportunity to show the cultural richness of the Met and how that can break down barriers, especially around the house-to-house inquiries that was not revealing much when white officers went to Black households. But when my colleagues, most of them from the Black Police Association, went, people opened the door because they shared their culture, their language, and we got witnesses, identified suspects who eventually got convicted. But I suppose for me, the added complication was Richard Taylor, Damilola's father, is my wife's cousin. And I had to make sure that all of the real complications of it didn't have an impact on the operational effectiveness of the case, and to make sure it was investigated thoroughly. So I didn't want to be a story within the story, as it were, and which I haven't really revealed until the book. So I was really pleased that we had a positive result, and it rekindled a friendship with Richard till this very day. And, you know, we support him, he supports us, and Of course, it's the 20th anniversary of Damilola's death next month, and sorry, November, and we'll be looking to support him as usual over the years. To say, listen, we got to prevent these forms of tragedies, you know, knife crime and violence. That's why I'm still so active in these areas in retirement with Voyage Youth and assisting young people to know their rights and responsibilities. So the struggle continues, and I'm pleased to have health and strength to do that.
Mm. The whole issue, you mentioned that, of course, that phrase that sort of struck such a chord in our nation, which was the suggestion that the Met is institutionally racist, that came out of the Macpherson inquiry. I was looking, and the current commissioner of the Met, Cressida Dick, said last year the Met had transformed. She said it was no longer institutionally racist, and said that that headline finding was essentially redundant, not a useful way, she said, to describe the service. And I don't believe we are. That's her words. Where are you on that one?
Well, I've gone on public record to say that it's not for Cressida Dick to say. It's not in her gift. That public inquiry of the British government in the form of Lord Macpherson said the institution of racism. So it has to be a governmental lead to say if they're not. And now I know the Home Affairs Select Committee was looking into that process late last year, but the elections and COVID has got in the way, and I'm hoping that they will report back at some stage to show evidence whether the Met Police are institutional racist or not. But I think that some of her pronouncements has really made me think so carefully about, well, how has she been helpful? Because 20 odd years ago, when she came back to the Met as commander and worked with John Greaves around the Macpherson recommendation, she actually walked the talk around institutional racism, saying, well, it's an aspiration to build on, to get a more reflective organisation, to be a police service fit for purpose for the 21st century. And now she just seems to have moved away from that. And it worries me. And especially a few weeks ago, she said that the Stephen Lawrence case was going to be shelved and it would only be reviewed every other year. And I thought, well, you don't have to do that, especially with this Black Lives Matter movement at the moment.
Let's talk about that, because, you know, we've started with the Met Police as one small part of a global force, essentially. We've seen such power and passion around the whole Black Lives Matter movement and the death of George Floyd. We've seen protests around the world. We've heard people at rallies saying defund the police. It's raised whole issues for many police forces globally about racism and the way that they police their communities. Are you optimistic that change is coming?
I would like to think so, because, you know, we saw change after Macpherson. You know, for 10 years, from 1999 to 2009, we saw changes internally, more effective organisation, and externally around service delivery to the community, and less disproportionality with stop and search, etc. Because we had independent oversight with the Stephen Lawrence Steering Group, chaired by various Home Secretaries, starting with Jack Straw, and the Lawrence family in attendance, primarily Neville and Doreen, and we saw improvements. Because what gets measured gets done. And the independent oversight made sure everything was measured. But when that steering group was eroded, dissolved, whatever, you then saw chief constables marking their own homework and making a decision whether it institutes a racist or not. And that's why you've got Krez talking about they're not, and it's not useful. Well, and that's counterintuitive of what's going on with communities saying, well, we know the police need to be reformed. And they know there's a way in which it can be done. And actually, the framework's already in place through the public health approach to reducing violence and making safer and stronger communities. Because it's there to change the approach to certain cases, like mental health cases or drug psychosis cases, or even young people involved in antisocial behavior. Instead of just police officers turning up there, it could be a triage approach, maybe paramedics, maybe social workers, whatever. So it's not just police turning up. And so you have to realign the funding of that. That's why the defunding title is very unhelpful, because people think you want to get rid of police services. No, you're just realigning the assets to make sure that police officers go to certain calls where they're really going to be an assistance and not part of the problem, just by turning up in uniform or what they do. So I really think there needs to be an understanding that the framework is there through the public health approach, and we don't have to go down that road of defunding the police, because it's unhelpful and it's not going to give us the progress we want.
How do you square the idea of a force that often now has to bear that suggestion that it is racist with individuals? Because I was thinking back to that advice that you were given early on in your career, where a couple of white officers said to you, don't judge a whole organization by a few bad officers. And I wonder whether you see young people coming into the force, people of every creed and color, who struggle with that suggestion by society, by people they meet, that they are part of something racist, and that feels like a very personal attack.
Well, the definition of institutional racism is nothing to do with individuals. It's around systemic failures. It's around collectively allowing certain impact of certain powers, like stop and search, where they're not actually doing something to change the disproportionality. And a lot of it is around how the criminal intelligence system makes a lot of assumptions and stereotypes about certain people of color and certain backgrounds. And you don't have the leadership saying, well, no, that's wrong. We need to be more intelligence-based, less assumptions being made. So because it's still there, because stop and search has been a real open sore of the Met for decades, especially since the Second World War with the SUS law, and even now, because no one's really got to grips to say, listen, we have got a problem here. We need to show proper supervision and leadership so that the officers know they have to be intelligence led around that power. And because we've seen the disproportionality increase recently, and trust and confidence, especially in the black community, has gone down, less trust in the police, that means less information to the police themselves. So officers, I think, need to understand each and every one of those encounters is a potential loss of faith in the police. Now, that shouldn't be, especially for a can-do, success-driven culture, that should be an aspiration to say, listen, we are going to prove to the public that we are able to come against any sort of label, you know, and not to be defined by that. Just like, you know, people used to call me the N-word or the W-word. I wasn't defined by that. I made sure that excellence was the best deterrent, and I would achieve despite whatever assumptions they have about me. Now, on an organizational level, you can do that, you know, with a strong narrative to say, we are going to change. We are going to acknowledge that there are failings, and we are going to ensure that we have clear performance indicators and way of measuring progress. At the moment, we don't see any progress because it's all kept in-house, and the government is not asking the Met to show, well, actually, how do you know you're not institutional racist? Give us the evidence. Because for an evidence-driven organization, there is a lack of evidence given by the commissioner and the rest of her team, and which I find really disappointing.
It's fascinating. I could talk about this with you for a lot longer. And I know you're still, although you've retired, you're still hugely engaged with issues like knife crime, working with young people. That comes across so strongly in your book, your passion for youth work and trying to help people stay out of trouble. I wonder, just as we close, given all of that we've reflected on and the challenges that you found there, do you ever wish you'd stuck with science, that you were still sitting there looking at cancer research?
Do you know, sometimes I still do feel, did I do the right thing? Because I did love science. But no, I think on reflection, I did the right thing. I remember when I was getting the MBE in 2000 and my father, with my mother, attended with Gretel and myself. And I remember him saying, well, I suppose you did the right thing after all. And that meant so much for me, because both of them were dead within 2 years of that event. And, you know, that gave me the sort of vindication that I'd done the right thing. And I suppose the way in which things have played itself out in terms of the book and the film, and you've got, you know, a person like Steve McQueen can identify the story in a way that, you know, he's not easily convinced, so it has to be good. And I suppose the support and the goodwill that's come out of it. And as I said, as a time such as this with the Black Lives Matter, I really think it's timely that we can all build together and have a society that really speaks volumes of us as the elders. Because in closing, my real joy is to see my grandchildren's generation living in an equal and meritocracy and a safe environment. I want that for my grandchildren's generation, because unfortunately I didn't see it in my children's generation or my generation. So I want to see my grandchildren's generation flourish in a more equitable, just society.
Leroy Logan, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. That's the perfect uplifting place for us to finish. And if you'd like to buy a copy of Leroy's book, Closing Ranks, My Life as a Cop, it's out now. You can simply click on the link in our podcast description. And don't forget, we've got plenty more fascinating perspectives from some of the biggest brains in the worlds of tech, business, science and culture. All you need to do is subscribe to Bocomi on your chosen audio platform, and we'd love to hear your feedback with a review while you're there. Our website, bocomi.com, is where you can sign up for our most wanted email, so you'll be ahead of the curve about our upcoming guests. I'm Rachel Schofield. Great to have you with us today. See you next time. Thank you.